You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We may have survived Hanukkah, Christmas, and Kwanzaa, but there are more hurdles lurking ahead. New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, plus all those other meals to follow in 2015. Luckily, Savera has a solution for you, or actually over 1,000 of them, in the form of the enticing recipes collected in Savera, the new classics cookbook. And I'm excited to welcome the magazine's contributing editor, Helen Rosner, and Adam Sachs, its editor-in-chief, to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Great to be here.
New Year's Eve and New Year's Day are often hard to prepare for because there aren't as many traditions as there are for other holidays other than the abuse of alcohol. Do you feel that they are a bit of a challenge?
There's certainly high expectations. I think that, everybody wants to have the best possible time, and that sets you up for failure a little bit more than other nights.
Do you have any favorite New Year's celebration foods?
Last year, we had some friends over and we grilled pig hearts and lamb's tongues and all sorts of odd things, and that just felt very satisfying somehow. Drank a lot of expensive champagne.
That's so normal.
If you drink enough alcohol, pig's hearts do seem appetizing.
Yeah, no, you don't. They were appetizing even in the beginning of the evening.
Go ahead.
I've just sort of given up and gone for classic, and I think I tend to do champagne and caviar as often as I possibly can. So New Year's Eve is a good excuse.
Well, definitely go to Helen's house.
How would one go about searching in this book for what one might want to serve?
Well, a good step one is to open the cover. But once you're inside, I think it all depends on the nature of your party. If you're going for a big cocktail thing where everyone's going to be passing stuff around, start at the beginning with hors d'oeuvres. And if you're having a big sit-down kind of family-style warm welcome in the new year with your loved ones dinner, well, pretty much the rest of the book will have you covered.
You've given us a number of recipes which we posted on our show page, like the French onion dip. Haven't you updated it from the original that all know and love from
the 50s
or so?
You know, I mean, the original is terrific. It's super, super flavorful. But these days, if you're going to, buy a packet of onion soup mix and mix it in with sour cream, I think your guests will ask for their money back. But what we've done with this recipe is we've used onions three different ways. So we have the onions themselves, which lend this incredible roasted sweet flavor in the traditional way that you'd bring the onions into the dip. And we also have some fried onions on top for some crispness and some green onions that add a little bit of tangy brightness.
And then you combine lemon juice and Worcestershire sauce and Tabasco.
Yeah, bring it all in. Make it as flavorful as possible.
But no sour cream.
No sour cream. You don't need it at that point.
That's sacrilegious.
You save it for the blinis and caviar.
Exactly. All the sour cream is underneath the caviar. You don't want to double up.
Well, how do you go about updating a classic recipe, whether it's for this book or for the magazine?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there are classics that, there's usually not one definitive recipe for anything that we think of as a classic. So you go back and you go to the sources and you read the people who fight over, which fish should be in the bouillabaisse or, which town has the true dish. And then you've kind of updated in interesting ways. Usually that just means adding fish sauce these days.
Well, I think adding fish sauce it really hits the nail on the head, though. If you look at
It was lemongrass 3 years ago.
Exactly. Fish sauce is the new lemongrass.
Harissa 3 years before that.
If you look at old cookbooks, if you think about American cookery and especially the way that America has served as a prism for global cuisine over the years, cookbooks from the 50s and 60s, even when they're talking about Italian food or French food or Mexican food that's really sort of conventional to our palate now, it'll call for like one garlic clove and then it will be optional. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the ways that we update classics is by going back and saying, well, what is the true thing that's happening here? I mean, if you're going to do the 1950s version of chicken with 40 cloves of garlic, it's going to be chicken with half an optional clove. And the real classic, the new classic, is not the 1950s American filtered version of this dish. It's the real, vermouth and tons of garlic sort of French countryside version of it.
Can you remember any particular recipes that were especially challenging to go back and deconstruct?
For this particular book, we tried really hard to do recipes that were approachable for the home cook. while still maintaining all of their authenticity. We didn't want to dumb anything down. We didn't want to substitute too many ingredients. The Indian recipes were a really interesting challenge. Indian food is extremely multivarious, and there's a huge amount of diversity across the Indian subcontinent and into Pakistan and the whole region. And I think for a lot of Americans, their appreciation of the food is like butter chicken.
Well, isn't that true for a lot of national cuisines? Mexican food is different practically from town to town. Chinese food changes from area to area. And you might even say that about food from this country.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most exciting things about a book like this and about what we do at Sever, which is this focus on regionalism, the specific flavors that you get when you go from town to town or neighborhood to neighborhood.
Yeah, I think the most exciting thing is not necessarily finding the, you know, again, one true recipe, but the stories behind them and what and how this became the recipe of this village versus, you know, the one over the next hill.
Same thing is true for French food, Italian food, definitely.
Yeah.
But I guess we could say it for pretty much any country in the world.
Yeah.
But we tend in this country to think of Italian food as an entity.
As one thing,
as
yeah.
French food as an entity, as Mexican food as tacos.
But we're moving away from it, which is great. I think, you know, particularly here in New York over the last 5 years, Italian food has become so regionalized. You know, you'll know that you're going to an Emilia Romanan restaurant or that you're going to a Ligurian restaurant, at least if you go to a certain type of Italian place. And even Italian-American food, the whole notion of hyphen American is no longer considered just Italian food. It's actually being elevated. I mean, what happens at a place like Terese or Carbone?
Right. It's a distinct cuisine that's developed on its own, has its own merits.
Yeah.
And
it's starting to happen with Mexican food.
Absolutely.
Well, it started, I thought, with Rosa Mexicano and Zarella, but we're seeing more and more of it since. You've called this book the New Classics Cookbook. Now, can a classic be new? Isn't a classic a classic?
I think it's...
Did you name this book?
I didn't, but I'm a big fan of the name. I think it actually very accurately describes the recipes within it. I think it's a little fallacious to assume that classic means old. I think classic means really good and really durable, and that often can be something that's within a new recipe. There are plenty of recipes in this book. I mean, the number on the cover is 1,000, but I think the actual figure, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, is 1,127.
Sure.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Within a margin of error.
I stopped at 623.
But there's a handful of recipes in this book the vast majority of them have impeccable and ancient provenance, but a handful were developed by Sever's test kitchen.
My guests are Helen Rosner, contributing editor at Sever, and national features editor of Eater.com, and Adam Sachs, who's the editor-in-chief of Sever magazine. We are talking about a new book called Sever, the New Classics Cookbook, which is fun to read because, maybe all cookbooks are fun to read on some level or have become more interesting in recent years. But in this case, you include quotes by various people like Ernest Hemingway on eating oysters that made me almost be able to taste them and made me hungry at the same time.
Yeah, you know, I think everybody loves food and some people are very eloquent about their love for it.
Yeah, I think we all want context when we read cookbooks. I mean, I love to curl up with a cookbook. If it's a good one at night, like it's a novel, I want more. I always want more head notes. I want more story, more context, how people came up with the recipe.
And that's something we're seeing more and more these days. In the old days, a cookbook would just simply be a bunch of recipes.
Right, just the guidelines.
So has food writing in general been changing over the years?
I think there's so much of it now that if you're writing a cookbook, unless you are bringing, you know, news from a part of the world that really hasn't been covered, which would be hard to name one, you know, you've got to explain why this French cookbook or why this French regional cookbook or why you as a chef, what you're bringing to the conversation.
Well, isn't that also true about having a magazine like Sever? When it was first published 20 years ago, it already had to deal with gourmet, bon appetit, food and wine. And distinguish itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think now the media, food media landscape has become so much more crowded, and people are, you know, there's just more there are more outlets for if you when Sever first came out, if you're you know, got an issue in the mail, and it would have a story about Corsican cuisine, and that was maybe your only source for finding out about Corsican cuisine. Now you could be in line at the supermarket and check your phone and look up 200 Corsican recipes or a blog that's based there, or, you know, find someone on Instagram who has great travel photos from there. So I think each of the magazines and websites needs to find a way to distinguish its viewpoint.
Before you took over from James Oslin just fairly recently at Sudbury, you worked for the competition, Bon Appetit, and then you had a column there, The Obsessivore, which won 2 James Beard Journalism Awards.
True.
What did you cover there?
The Obsessivore was a column about sort of an amateur enthusiast in the kitchen. So if the idea was that everyone else who writes for these glossy food magazines knows what they're talking about, and The Obsessivore was someone who was an enthusiast, who was very into the idea, but would always get in over his head and try things that didn't quite make sense and were a little goofy but fun.
Are you bringing that same spirit to Sever?
I'd like to. I mean, certainly not the same, that exact column, but the idea of, that our reader is probably immersed in this world of food media, and it's not the first time they're, you know, reading about provincial French food, but maybe they want to go deep and learn how to make a recipe and take on big challenges. And I like the idea of having some first person sort of adventurous cooking.
Getting back to some of the things we might do for the upcoming holidays, the parsley and red onion salad, which we have also posted on our show page, is elegantly simple, yet with unexpected subversive additions like lemon juice and zest. But this is a recipe that goes back to the 80s. Can we often identify when a recipe was actually invented?
Well, so this particular recipe comes from Jeremiah Tower, who is having such a moment right now as he's sort of coming out of retirement to take over the kitchen at Tavern on the Green. But in terms of provenance, it's easy to identify the origination of a dish when it appears on a menu or when it's first published in a cookbook or a magazine. And certainly there are plenty of cooks working today, probably more than at any other time, who are truly developing absolutely new things using bizarre and magical technologies. But, you know, this is at its core a very simple salad. It's parsley and red onion and some aromatics and some you know, nice astringent elements. And you toss it all together and serve it on toast points. And, you know, parsley's been around for far longer than Jeremiah Tower has, but
just barely.
But it also really speaks to him. And I think it, in a lot of ways, embodies this notion of a new classic. What you were asking about before, can a classic be new? When he was cooking in the 80s, he was doing this incredibly fiery, flavorful, really bombastic cuisine that defined and shaped what we think of now as California cooking.
There's a new documentary about the origins of General Tso's chicken. I don't know if you've seen it, but they try to find out how this thing became so ubiquitous in Chinese restaurants all over the country. And it turns out, after a lot of searching, that it was invented by somebody in Taiwan, a chef who came to the United States at a certain point to start his own restaurant, which failed, actually, even though he was a great chef, Chef Peng. And now he's back in Taiwan. But its origins were so clouded that people thought it either was an American invention like chop suey or egg foo young, or that it was something that went back hundreds of years to the time when General Tso was alive. But you can trace some of these things actually to a person who sat down and said, okay, I'm going to do this with chicken. I'm going to create this kind of sauce.
Sure. I mean,
unfortunately for Chef Peng, it's been totally distorted. And sugar has been added. He's horrified at that.
Well, we got to bring that back. We've got to find, we've got to give it the Sever treatment, you know, find the real General Tso's chicken.
And I think, you know, a lot of conversations around authenticity and finding these original dishes can get tricky, because maybe that's a moment where someone just gave a dish that had been in common parlance or usage a specific name, or they named it after, you know, some a restaurant or a royal, you know, court or something. And it doesn't mean necessarily that is something completely new.
I love that, though. I mean, in the course of researching this cookbook, one of the queries that my editor kept coming back with over and over and over again was whenever a dish had a name that clearly was a proper name, she was like, well, where does this come from? And it turns out a lot of Scandinavian desserts are named after opera singers. Mm-hmm.
Peach Melba.
Peach Melba, for sure. There are just, you know, when you put someone's name on it, you're telling a story in a really immediate and very shorthand kind of way.
My guests are Helen Rosner, who's a contributing editor at Surveyor Magazine and national features editor of Eater.com. We're talking about a new cookbook from Surveyor called The New Classics Cookbook. It is published by who's publishing
Weldon
this?
Owen.
Weldon Owen. And also with us is Adam Sachs, the editor-in-chief of Surveyor, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're talking about the new classics cookbook from Surveyor, which has over 1,000 recipes, and we have a few of them on our show page, for French onion dip, parsley and red onion salad, and also flourless chocolate souffle. My guests are Adam Sachs, who's editor-in-chief of Surveyor, and Helen Rosner, a contributing editor at the magazine. And you are, how much are you responsible for this book, Helen?
Don't be modest.
No, I you know, this was a huge group effort. The book was, and this is not a, you know, a canned line. The book was 20 years in the making. This is, in a lot of ways, a greatest hits effort representing a very small portion of the huge, huge, huge recipe archive that Surveyor has amassed over the course of its existence as a brand.
Did you change, if you found something that was great 20 years ago, 15 years ago, did you still tweak it?
We did a little bit of retesting for the book, but, you know, over the history of the magazine, there's been such a rigorous, rigorous testing process and such rigorous research. Almost every single recipe in this book at some point or another and in some form or another is something I have consumed, which you can tell by looking at me. But you know, the old recipes are great. Surveyor from the beginning has been all about, you know, we never did the just one clove of garlic thing. If they were cooking it with 1,000 cloves of garlic, we put all 1,000 in.
What led you to change the traditional chocolate souffle to a flourless one?
You know, that's a recipe that I was introduced to by the current test kitchen director, Faraday Sadegan, at Surveyor. And it predates both of our time at the magazine. But she made it for me one day when I was just sort of complaining about wanting chocolate. And it is such a simple, fantastic recipe. And I'm an amateur home cook. I mean, I work at a food magazine, but I've never been to culinary school. I've never worked in a restaurant. And I've always found souffles to be the most intimidating thing in the entire world, like I think a lot of people have. And
well, you're afraid to walk around the kitchen while it's in the
exactly.
oven.
Exactly. Right. It's so delicate.
Turn it has away for too long.
Such sensitive feelings. And watching the test kitchen whip up these souffles and throw them in the oven, and the office was filled with the most intense, aromatic, rich smell. I mean, everybody was swooning. And then they came out of the oven, and they were absolutely gorgeous, and they were terrific. And I said, oh, my God, show me how to make this. And it turns out it's a cinch. And even for someone who's inept and impatient like I am, as long as you have good chocolate and good sugar and good eggs, you've got a terrific dessert.
Must you bake them in a ramekin?
They're individual chocolate souffles. So they don't have flour. I said flour.
No, yeah, no flour. at least not the flourless ones.
That's right. It would be weird typically if they had flour. No, because they don't have flour, the structure is slightly different. So these are served in individual ramekins. And you know, there's no water bath. They just bake on a cookie sheet in the oven. It's really simple.
An important factor might be the kind of chocolate you use. Some recipes actually tell you what brand, what kind of chocolate. Is that all that important?
I have no idea.
It is. You know, I don't want to speak with too much expertise because, like I said, I'm just a passionate amateur.
Is it about the weight? What is the
weight? Well, there's a big difference between, let's say, a European chocolate and an American chocolate.
It's a fat thing, right? It's about the butter fat or the milk fat or something lipid.
Makes now, sense. You separate the yolks and the whites at different points of making this souffle. Separating of eggs is often a fascinating factor for me. Why here and not there? Is the timing of a recipe all that important?
You know, in baking, it is particularly more important, I think, than in general, than it is with savory cooking. In this particular recipe, temperatures are important because you're trying to, what am I trying to say? The egg yolks and the egg whites serve different functions. The egg whites basically provide structure. The proteins are the scaffolding and the architecture for this. And the yolks provide richness and they provide depth and they provide flavor. So the physics of an egg, which I'm sure more people have written and spoken about far more eloquently than I have.
It's chemistry.
It is. Chemistry, you're right. Well, all chemistry is physics at an atomic level, I guess. The chemistry of the egg is affected by temperature. You know, if you whip egg whites in a very, very well-chilled bowl, they'll hold a stiffer peak for longer. So it gives you a little bit of flexibility when it comes to, you know, adding the chocolate, putting them into the ramekins, getting them into the oven.
I just love separating eggs, and I love recipes that say, you know, leave for another purpose. I'd love if there was a cookbook that was just what to do with all the yolks.
The other purpose.
Yeah, all the yolks you've left, or the bones, or the whites.
Well, what do you do with all the whites that are left out when you make an ice cream, for example?
But
for me, it even gets more basic. What happens when a little piece of the shell falls in and I can't get it out?
You put your finger in it.
No, chopsticks. This is magical. If you take a wooden chopstick, one of the ones that like comes with your takeout that you would throw into the junk drawer, and just put it near the little bit of white near the little bit of shell in the bowl of egg whites, it magically is attracted to the chopstick.
Wow.
And just pull it right out.
Now I know. I knew there was a reason to save those chopsticks.
Helpful lesson.
Can you talk a bit about how you've organized this cookbook? Because it's not typical.
I think it's pretty typical.
You have ingredients, you have origin, even the different states in the country.
Oh, the index. Yeah. I mean, so the index is actually my favorite part of the entire book, which is a very nerdy thing to admit. But like most cookbooks, and certainly most cookbooks of this size, this is a giant 630-page doorstopper of a book, we have a general index where everything is organized alphabetically by ingredient and recipe name. But we have this second index that I am desperately in love with, which is the index of geographic origin. And that was really a necessity, I think, to be true to the soul of what Sevres is. We're a magazine that's committed to the whole world of food. And if you're interested in Senegalese cooking, or you're interested in Russian cooking, or you're interested in Lebanese cooking, you could flip through the 1,000 recipes and, you know, wait for one to catch your eye. But it's nice to look it up by country.
And on top, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that's one thing that distinguishes this book from sort of other omnibus, big, you know, giant collections of cookbooks, classic recipes, is this idea that Sevres has always been a magazine that followed food to its source. And that here, you know, in this collection of recipes from the past 20 years, you can really go, as Helen said, you know, if you're in the mood for Senegalese, if you're in the mood for Australian, French, whatever it is you've got a taste for, you can go straight there, which is a great way to navigate the book.
And then there are these tips that surprised me, like for perfect pasta, you say toast your black pepper.
Well, if you're for perfect anything, I really think you should be toasting your
everything
black pepper. Pepper behaves just like any other.
You just don't grind it and put it on top?
You can. You could totally grind it. But, you know, if you have any familiarity with Indian cooking, for example, you'll know that spices get toasted in a dry skillet, and heating them up releases all of these extraordinary aromatics, and it intensifies their flavor and intensifies the nose. And black pepper is actually an incredibly exotic spice that just happens to have made its way into conventionality in the American culinary vernacular. And it behaves just the same way that star anise or you know, coriander seed or something would behave. If you throw it into a skillet, especially if you're using olive oil, if you essentially fry it in olive oil, you infuse the olive oil with this hot, warm, peppery flavor, and then the pepper itself really takes on this explosive vibrance.
And then you cook with the olive oil as well?
Absolutely. Toss your pasta in it.
Or just toast it in a dry pan and then crush it with a mortar and pestle, and it does add a dimension to the flavor.
Yeah, it'll make the best cacio e pepe you'll ever have.
You also have a thing, Skimming 101, where you use either a cold spoon or the spin method.
The spin method's a lot of fun. That's great. That's where you just stir really, really fast, create a vortex, and just like scoop out all the stuff from the center. It's really emotionally gratifying.
And why use a cold spoon in particular?
The cold spoon, I think, and I'm going to just make up the science here, I think the cold spoon operates kind of similarly to this chopstick and piece of eggshell thing. The cold spoon attracts the smudge, the foam and junk that's on the top of your broth, and it's much more drawn to it, and it makes it easier to pull out. It's a fun little kitchen science trick.
I just have to read out loud Anthony Bourdain's pull quote on this page. He says, "To me, life without veal stock, pork fat, sausage, organ meat, demi-glace, or even stinky cheese is a life not worth living."
Low standards, that guy.
I also just happened upon a friend of our show here, Lou DiPaolo's spaghetti and meatballs with shredded Parmesan and ricotta as well.
Oh, those are the meatballs to die for. Those are the meatballs. There's just there's no other meatball. That's the meatball.
Do they sell those at DiPaolo's, or are they ready made?
I think you have to make it.
You have to make them.
But you want to buy the ricotta.
You want to buy the ricotta.
Okay. And the Parmesan.
And then the book.
And then the book. In that order.
My guests are Helen Rosner and Adam Sachs. We're talking about Sever and a new cookbook that features over 1,100,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you can.
Recipes from Sever under the complete title, The New Classics Cookbook. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Where in terms of world food are you most excited by the flavors? You mentioned Indian food a couple of times.
I am excited by Indian food. Personally, though, at the moment, I like the rest of the world. I'm pretty obsessed with Mexico. There have been some really extraordinary restaurants that have been opening here in New York that are exploring the flavors of Mexico. And there's been just tremendous interest in chilies and spices and herbs and corn.
Many years ago, the woman who started Rosa Mexicano, Josefina Howard, told me that Mexico has the second most recipes in the world after Chinese food because it is so regional and there were so many different cultures all living in this same area. You know, the north is totally different from the south, and the Aztecs had nothing to do with the Mayans or the Zapotecs. And then, of course, in comes Spain, in comes France. The Dutch, the British, it is probably the ultimate fusion cuisine.
We did an issue of Sever that was totally dedicated to Mexico a couple of years ago, and it remains one of my favorite issues of the magazine that's ever come out. And I remember being really surprised when we were testing all of these regional recipes over the course of producing the issue at how much the food from the south of Mexico, basically, from the southern most points, used the palate that to me was the Thai palate. There was a lot of, you know, cilantro. There was a lot of brightness and tomato and lime, and there was essentially fish sauce. And it was this moment for me where I realized exactly what you were saying, that Mexico has such phenomenal diversity within its flavors, and you know, something from Puebla and something from Oaxaca and something from the Yucatan there's a common soul that threads through all of them, but they're so extraordinarily different.
I was in the Yucatan, and I had a dish that really exemplifies this. The Yucatan, for many years, was cut off from the rest of Mexico, so it received things from other parts of the world. And the Dutch traders came, and they brought rounds of Edam cheese, and the locals cut the cheese through the middle, filled it with beans and meat and spices and everything, and then put the thing back together, baked it, and then cut off slices as a pie. And that's what they call the Yucatecan national dish.
Okay, that's what I'm having for New Year's.
Sounds amazing.
I've changed my answer. That sounds delicious.
No more pig hearts.
But the genius of cooks. You work with what you have available, and you come up with something that is very much your own.
And the beauty of food, too, that, you know, all it takes is, you know, the arrival of a new cheese to kind of change the direction of a cuisine.
Well, I think fusion has become such a dirty word, but all cooking is fusion. I think, you know,
French food largely comes from Italy and Spain, but the French did something with it that made it uniquely French.
Yeah. And the Italians wouldn't be anywhere without the tomatoes brought over from
South America. And
potatoes,
you know, Sicily wouldn't be anywhere without Northern Africa. I mean, the whole everything is everything, you know?
Well,
Helen, I understand you're a particular fan of certain recipes for New Year's Eve that we haven't included on our show page. What do you like about gougères?
I like gougères because they're delicious, but I really like them because they're easy. I think that so gougères are these delicious little pastry puffs that are just sort of a classic French pâté choux, and it's the same pastry that you use for a cream puff or an éclair. And instead of filling it with sweet cream or with pastry cream for an éclair, you grate just a ton of Gruyere cheese into this dough, and it makes it super savory and salty and delicious and rich. And you make little puffs on a cookie sheet. And what I always do, and what works so flawlessly for this is to make them a couple of days ahead of time and then take this cookie sheet and throw it in the freezer for about an hour and then take the frozen puffs and throw them into a Ziploc bag and, you know, repeat the process a couple of times till you have a couple of Ziploc baggies of ready-to-go gougère and then pop them in the oven in the middle of the party.
Not in the bag.
That will melt. It will taste
better. But they're wonderful. They go great with champagne.
They're perfect.
You break into a sweat while you're making the pâté choux, but you feel very suave when you serve them.
Well, that's why you make them a week ahead of time. Right.
And then I discovered that Ella Fitzgerald, one of my favorite singers, had a favorite cheddar cheese log.
She did. And this recipe, it's a classic cheddar cheese log. It's a cheese ball. It's cheese, you know, blended with mustard and Tabasco and covered in chopped nuts, and this fantastically retro recipe. It's actually not Ella Fitzgerald's recipe, though we attribute it to her in the book. She found it in one of James Beard's cookbooks, and in her copy of that book, she had that page really extensively annotated. And it turns out Ella Fitzgerald was this huge fan of James Beard's cheese log, which I think is such a beautiful illustration of the way recipe attribution flows over time.
What about Elvis Presley's pound cake?
Oh, that's a real heartstopper.
Did he take it from somebody else?
That's not his personal recipe that he cooked. It was, according to some writers, it's a recipe that was his favorite that a woman used to make for him regularly. And she'd make him two, one for him to give to his staff. And, you know, presumably a couple dozen people would share this one loaf. And the second one was for him to eat all by himself.
And remembering what he looked like late in his life, he must have eaten a lot of them.
Yeah, I would say, you know, pay attention to the serving size on that one.
Adam Sever's new issue is out, the Sever 100 Cooks Edition. You include 100 new ideas, tips, and or tools from a wide array of people, most of them food people or people like Ella Fitzgerald and Elvis Presley.
Ella Fitzgerald and Elvis Presley did not make it into this issue, but there will always be another Sever 100. We call this one the Cooks Edition, and the cooks in that title refers to home cooks, but a lot of the advice and tips and ideas came from working chefs because, you know, they're the ones in the field playing around and coming up with new ideas.
I was intrigued by the possibility of being able to make my own butter using a Chef and Buttercup butter maker. You don't have to churn the milk?
I think you just shake that one. I mean, you can make your own butter pretty easily at home, but it just makes it a bit more convenient.
My own butter whenever I try to make whipped cream and I forget about it.
You just go too long?
I just go like 3 seconds too long and, oh, guys, we have fresh butter.
Is it as good as the best butter? Can you adjust it? For example, butters change so much from country to country and even from producer to producer.
Right. I think the quality of your butter is always going to be dependent on the quality of your milk. But you could add sea salt. You could make it a little bit firmer or softer depending on your taste.
You also suggest roasting white chocolate, which will make it more caramelly.
Yeah, I think this is a great tip where you roast, quality white chocolate in it, and it sort of it gets that browning effect, and it just sort of deepens the flavor of something that sometimes is thought of as a bit of a throwaway.
And you suggest blow drying chicken instead of patting it with paper towels.
If you're worried about having a bad chicken hair day, that is if you want to get the crispest skin on any bird. The recipes always call for totally drying the skin, and there's no way to do this really because you could use up 3 rolls of paper towels and the bird is still wet somehow. So we played around with an air compressor and just blasting it with air.
So you could do a hair dryer?
You could do it with a hair dryer. I don't know if that would start to cook it, but an air compressor, you could stop at a gas station, I guess, on the way home from the grocery and just instead of filling up your tires, just blast it with that.
You also use things like trimmings from radishes or celery or whatever. You roast meat on top of them?
Yeah, there's a section we have which is sort of acknowledging this whole idea of root-to-stock cooking or this idea of not throwing anything away. And chefs all over the country and all over the world really are finding uses for the tops of things and the skins of things and things that used to get thrown away and doing inventive dishes with them.
Will you both be taking your own advice on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day?
I will be going to a friend's house where I have a feeling they will, in fact, have champagne, caviar, and gougère.
So you'll just bring a bottle of wine?
Yeah, I'm just going to show
up. I'm going to ask you for that Mexican cheese pie recipe.
Okay. Well, thank you both so much for being on our show. We've been talking about Sever, both the magazine and the new cookbook called Sever, the new classics cookbook, with Adam Sachs, who's editor-in-chief of Sever, and Helen Rosner, who's a contributing editor at Sever and the national features editor at Eater.com. And you can find recipes from this book for French onion dip, parsley and red onion salad, and flourless chocolate souffle on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
It was a pleasure.
Great to be with you. Thanks.